This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers. I'm speaking with Michael Shermer, the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, the author of many books and articles, including Why People Believe Weird Things and The Science of Good and Evil. His newest book is Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown. It's a collection of essays exploring the clash between the known and the unknown. Michael Shermer, welcome to KABU.
Thank you for having me on.
How did you become so skeptical?
Well, in general, I'm interested in the sciences, and science is skepticism, and skepticism is the scientific way of thinking. Skepticism is not a noun. It's, you know, a skeptic, like it's a thing. It's just an approach to claims. Like, there's those that doubt that the Holocaust happened, and they consider themselves skeptics. And when I did a big investigation of them, I ended up being skeptical of the skeptics. So in that case, I guess I was a true believer or whatever. So it's not a, you know, position you take. It's just an approach. And when I was in graduate school the first time in the 1970s in a psych program, experimental psychology, these psychics like Uri Geller were all the rage, and they were being tested by these experimental psychologists. And I remember thinking, well, these guys are smarter than me, and they think there's something to it. Maybe there's something to it, so I should keep an open mind. But then I saw the amazing Randy on The Tonight Show. With Johnny Carson, because Johnny's interested in magic and Randy does magic. But Randy, in this case, was showing how the psychics use magic tricks and that these are tricks, not actual psychic powers, or at least it looks like they're magic tricks and Randy could do them just as well as the psychics. So that got me to realize that science has certain limitations and that scientists, for example, are not trained to detect intentional deception on the part of their subjects. They're, you know, white rats don't cheat and nature doesn't cheat, right? So then I realized, okay, so we can be fooled pretty easily. Even people that are smart and educated who are trained in the rigors of science can still be fooled. So there's something else going on here, and that has to do with how belief systems work, how the mind works, how we perceive things, how we process data and information through theories and models and biases that we hold. And that's how I got into that subject.
And I read that you also were quite religious at that point. Was that correct?
I was in college for about 6 years, high school through college and into graduate school. I was fairly religious. Yeah, I was a born-again evangelical Christian, and I was a creationist. So, you know, when I, as an evolutionary theorist now, or somebody defends evolutionary theory, I know the arguments well because I used to make them. So I know what my debate opponents are going to say. And it also gives me some insight into the psychology of religious beliefs. You know, if you really believe, whichever religion you're committed to, if you really believe, it's somewhat immoral to not try to convince other people of the truth. I mean, you are talking about eternal life and the ultimate meaning of life and God and all this stuff. And when you know you have the truth, how criminal it would be actually to not tell other people about it and try to convince them. And that is the mindset. Ultimately, fundamentalism is dangerous of any kind because it leads you to the inevitable conclusion you must convince other people that you're right, that you have the truth with a capital T. And one of the things that appeals to me about science is that it's much more ecumenical and tolerant, open-minded, provisional, tentative. It makes you humble before the facts because there are no facts, 100% proven things in science. There's just these provisional truths that we have with the small t, and it makes you a little more willing to tolerate diversity because you realize you could be wrong.
And that gets at some of the things I wanted to ask you about, because there are some of these basic questions that you alluded to there that underlie a lot of what you write about, and they're very interesting big questions like what do we know and what do we not know. Anything that you can say about how you approach that question, for instance, what do we know and what do we not know, that would be helpful to kind of understand.
Yeah, I think if we think of humans as pattern-seeking, pattern-recognition machines, I mean, our brains are programmed by evolution to learn things, to connect A to B, to find the patterns, to see the constellations in the night sky, to see the pattern of migrations of the herd animals, to see the patterns of seasons and things like that. That's part of our survival. It's built into us. We have to be able to do that. The problem is it's not a foolproof pattern recognition device in our brains. Sometimes we think we recognize patterns that, in fact, are not real at all. They're just entirely made up, and these are called superstitions. And the more uncertain the environment, the more likely you are to hold superstitions, and there's a lot of variables like that, but it's not foolproof. So there's no way to get rid of superstitions, and it actually is quite orthogonal to or independent of intelligence, education, and so on. I've met some of the smartest people, most educated people, PhDs and so on, that believe the goofiest things. And it amazes me. How can you believe this nonsense? It's obviously
like false.
Oh, like, well, I guess things like astrology or some of the New Age beliefs or that quantum mechanics explains psychic power or even ESP, that kind of stuff. I mean, trained scientists will all of a sudden shift from the controlled experiment mode to determining what's real to the anecdotal mode that somebody heard that there was a Bigfoot roaming around in the hinterlands of the northwestern United States, and so there must be something to it. I mean, it's like – but you wouldn't think like that in your own field. Whatever your own field is, why would you then just fully accept these claims that people make uncritically? And it turns out, and like religion is a classic example of this, that it turns out that, you know, virtually all religious tenets can only be held by faith, by a leap of faith. You can't prove these things. You can't prove the resurrection of Christ, and you can't prove that there's a God using science. These are articles of faith, and yet plenty of scientists, smart PhD scholars and so on, are deeply religious, even though they can't prove it. And it's obviously related to how they were raised and where they were born and so forth, because that's the religion they hold. They hold the religion of their parents or of their culture. And that alone tells us something about belief systems. These are obviously human constructions. They're socially constructed and determined. Even science, you know, of course, whenever I say that, I inevitably get asked in talks, well, of course, then science is socially constructed. Well, yes, it is. Of course, it's done by people. But science has a built-in self-correcting machinery that helps weed through biases and flaws and prejudices and the theories, political, social attitudes that scientists hold. Because if you don't try to find where the flaw is in your system, somebody else will. In fact, probably before you even get published, they will send your paper out to blind peer reviewers. They don't know who you are. You don't know who they are. They're just reading the paper, trying to be as fair and objective as they can be. And that's not a foolproof system, but it's a way of checks and balances that, such that when something gets into print, hopefully there's at least been some screening method there. And when somebody makes an outlandish claim or an extraordinary claim, your colleagues will ask you, where's the extraordinary evidence for this extraordinary claim? What have you got? Show us. Prove it to us before we endorse it. And that's what science has that most traditions, knowledge traditions, don't have. You rarely hear a politician say, I've been reassessing the data on gun control, for example, and I was wrong. I've changed my mind. You rarely hear that because that's how a scientist thinks. But that's not how, say, a politician or a theologian. You rarely hear a theologian say, you know, I've been sort of going over the arguments by the atheists and the agnostics and the theists and the Christians and so on. And I, you know what, this can't, I can't really prove that, you know, the resurrection happened. I might as well not be a Christian. I've changed my mind. I mean, that never happens. I mean, sometimes people become less religious for personal emotional reasons, but not because of logic and reason.
Mm-hmm. So how do you or I, as an individual, how do you verify something? How do you actually know that the scientists, I mean, don't we sort of live in a culture of depending on quote-unquote experts to tell us these
things? We do, yes. But in the case of science, at least, we have a certain level of trust that the scientists are checking each other and that the checkers have checkers. And there's checks and balances there. And so, look, I don't really understand quantum mechanics. Hardly anybody does. String theory, to explain the cosmos and all this stuff. I mean, I read about it. I can read the popular versions, but I don't know the math. But I rely on my friends at Caltech, for example, where I live in Pasadena. But these guys are – they're checking those equations and they're checking each other. And I know how competitive scientists can be, just like any other profession, and that the guys at MIT, maybe they don't like the guys at Caltech and they're going to triple check the equations by the guy at Caltech to make sure he got it right. And they'd love nothing better than to debunk this guy. So I rely on that system and it really does work quite well. I mean, these scientists debunk each other right and left. They don't need the skeptics to investigate a lot of these things. And that gives me confidence, not faith, but confidence that the system of checks and balances will lead us toward a greater understanding of the way the world really is.
I guess one question would be related to that. That's something that's touched on in your book, is when does theory become accepted as fact?
Right. This has certainly come up a lot recently with this whole creationist intelligent design theory movement of getting stickers, for example, placed in textbooks in Georgia that say evolution is only a theory. You should keep an open mind and investigate other theories. Like what? Because there aren't any other scientific theories. And no one would propose putting such a sticker in, say, a physics textbook that says gravity is only a theory. You should keep an open mind and investigate other theories. Like what? What other theories besides gravity are there for why objects are attracted to one another? Or a geology textbook that plate tectonics is only a theory. I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. Of course they're theories. That's what science is based on. But people have this misunderstanding. Oh, theory is just sort of a wild guess or something. No, it's a well-founded, tested, over and over corroborated model that explains the data better than any other model, and that's the accepted one. And it takes a long time. Believe me, science is very conservative. It has to be because of all the goofball ideas out there that people have. And it has to weed through them very carefully and to overthrow an existing paradigm or model or worldview or theory. And at this point, I would be shocked if it turned out evolution wasn't true, because there's so much corroborating evidence for over a century of independent lines of inquiry from different fields conducted by people who don't even know each other. They don't go to the same conferences. They don't publish in the same journals. It's not like they're meeting on the weekend saying, look, we got to get our story straight. Those creationists are out there, so I'm going to say this. They don't do that. But they come up with the same answer, roughly the same answer of how old things are, who descended from whom, and so on. And that's how we know it happened.
Talking about the whole issue of theories and the
intelligent design theory, yes.
The intelligent design theory.
Clever name, isn't it? It sounds really technical.
Yeah, and you have an essay about this in your book, and it sounds like the people who came up with this are trying to make it parallel to a scientific...
Oh, absolutely they are, yeah. In science fiction, I have a chapter called The New Creationism, because the last chapter I wrote in a previous book was The New Creationism. These guys keep evolving and mutating into new species, which isn't supposed to happen. But essentially, I'll give you the Reader's Digest condensed version here. The first strategy back in the 1910s and 20s was the banning of evolution, and this culminated in the 1925 Scopes monkey trial in Dayton, Tennessee, in which John T. Scopes taught evolution contrary to Tennessee state law, and he was in violation of the law. So he was tried and found guilty, which was they wanted to happen so they could challenge it and take it to the U.S. Supreme Court, because it's a violation of First Amendment. You can't teach Genesis in public schools. That's religion. Government can't endorse religion. But de facto, what happened was from 1925 to 1960 or so, evolution was simply not taught because teachers wanted to avoid the controversy. They just didn't want to deal with it. And want irate parents coming in and fundamentalist principles and so on. So then after the Sputnik scare, there was a fear that we were getting behind the Soviets in science and technology. So there was an emphasis on teaching of science in all fields, including theory of evolution. So the second strategy by the creationists was to demand equal time for Genesis and Darwin. And they lost all those court battles because, again, you can't teach Genesis in public schools. The government cannot endorse religion. Okay? Third strategy, 1980s, equal time for evolution-science and creation-science. Very clever. They just stuck the word science on their name, and they said, see, this isn't religion. This is science. See, it's even in the it's even in the title of our books. And they lost in Arkansas and Louisiana, two big cases in which the judges determined that, in fact, it was just religion masquerading as science, and that doesn't make it science. Science is as science does. You actually have to do science. And they don't do any science. There's no laboratories. There's no research. They don't publish anything. They're just religious polemicists. And this finally culminated in 1987, where the U.S. Supreme Court voted on the appeal of the Louisiana case. And they voted 7-2, Justices Scalia and Rehnquist dissenting, that the Louisiana law was correct, saying you cannot force public school teachers to teach a religious doctrine. And I thought that was the end of that. And this will go away. And I wrote a chapter in my book, Why People Believe Weird Things, about that. And I thought, okay, I won't have to write about this anymore. Well, in the 90s evolved this whole new system of thought called intelligent design theory. Same arguments, a little more sophisticated, different examples, but the argument is the same, that the universe looks designed, life looks designed, it's complex, how do you explain that? Darwin can't explain it, you scientists can't explain it, therefore the intelligent designer did it. They wisely quit using the G word. They don't say God did it. They never mention the Bible. They never talk about religion, even though they're all, to a person, evangelical Christians. You know, no coincidence there. And so they say it's an intelligent design. So, you know, we have all their arguments. I have all the arguments in science fiction and the counter-arguments, why this is not true. But we have to realize deep down it's the same arguments. It's a religious movement. It's a political religious movement. It has nothing to do with science.
It's like science is being turned on its head or something in order to facilitate a belief in this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the reason for that is because we live in the age of science. So if you really want credibility, you got to have that imprimatur of science and publication in science journals, recognition of leading scientists and so on. That's the feeling that they have. The mistake they're making, I think, is that's not what religion's about. Religion is not about proving your tenets through experiments or through logic or reason. It's really about making a faith commitment, an emotional commitment to a particular belief system for very personal reasons that have nothing to do with what science does. And as I said, the reason most people are religious is because they were raised that way or their parents were that way. And most people choose the religious systems that they were raised with. Same thing usually with political ideas and commitments to economic ideologies. It's how you were raised, what part of the country, whether you're conservative or liberal. You know, it's no mistake that our country is pretty much divided the way it is because politically, because political attitudes and commitments have very little to do with reason and logic and empiricism and data and experiments, and this is really the best. It's how we're raised, what we're comfortable with emotionally. And that is really quite a polarizing effect.
I'm speaking with Michael Shermer. He's the author of the new book, Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown. And related to that, I guess one of the questions I had for you was, what's wrong with someone believing in a religion, especially if it gives them comfort or solace?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing wrong with it at all. The only fear or concerns I have is fundamentalism of any kind, not just religious, but political, ideological, whatever. And in terms of religion, it's also worrisome if it's wedded to the state, if there's too much state power. Religion by itself is not especially dangerous. I mean, you can burn a few witches here and there and commit a few pogroms of small scale. It's when you have state power, when you have weapons. That's when it gets dangerous. And that's why theocracies are so dangerous. In fact, I argue the best thing for religion is the separation of church and state. It's obviously good for government, for religion to be out of the government business. But is it good for religion? And the answer is yeah, it is. Because look how flourishing American religions are, how well they're doing compared to, say, religions in Europe, which are just dry as dust, boring, dead, dormant, asleep organizations. In America, they're dynamic, alive. They're filled with music and chanting people, and active members of the community are involved and so on, and they raise huge amounts of money. I claim that they're able to do this because they don't have government help. They are like corporations in a free market of ideas. They have to compete with one another. So they've ratcheted up the scale of getting people committed to give their time and energy and money. And they've perfected fundraising techniques and mass marketing, telemarketing. All these techniques were developed by religion first before really corporate America figured it out. And that's why I think Americans are more religious than Europeans, because we have separation of church and state. They don't get a dime from the government. At least they shouldn't.
But that separation, at least currently, in the last few years, looks like it's becoming less certain. It's becoming more permeated.
In some areas, yes. Of course, conservatives want more government in the bedroom and less government in the boardroom. So they don't want religion involved in business. They want religion involved in our personal moral lives. But that's pretty predictable. Liberals are on the opposite side of that camp. So
you don't see that as a worrisome trend?
Oh, yeah, I do. I worry about it. I do. Particularly in the realm of, say, religion and prayer in public schools, things like that, Ten Commandments in courtrooms. They don't belong there. I mean, look, the under God does not belong in the pledge. It doesn't. It shouldn't be there. God we trust should not be on the money. It shouldn't. It can't be any clearer. It doesn't belong there. It's obvious. Now, the best argument anybody can come up with is, well, it's already there and it's not a big deal. Yeah, that's true. It's already there and it isn't a big deal. It's not, you know, going to lead to the collapse of Western civilization because we have In God We Trust in the money. It's not going to violate our civil liberties or something like that. But the counterargument to that is once you breach that wall and you start going down that path, then you risk having more and more involvement where, say, there are government funds going to certain charity organizations that are based on religion or religious schools, something like that. They have no business doing that. And we have to stop. You have to stop the flood somewhere.
Well, also, you make reference in the book to a poll that was taken a while back, I think, and that found that 50, I'm not sure if this is exact statistic, but it was under 50% of people would vote for an atheist for president.
Oh, it was unbelievable, yes.
And I think that's in the last election, we certainly saw a lot of conversation about what a candidate needed to do to appeal to people as far as religion goes. And they wanted, it would seem from the polling that was done, they wanted someone that went to church regularly and, mm-hmm. you know, stood up for their religious beliefs, etc. So to me, that area is also becoming even more...
very disturbing. If I was running for office and asked, I'd say it's none of your business. It has nothing to do with my ability to govern as a state functionary. And yet most people think that it does. Well, why? I mean, in fact, that's a problem. If I'm going to be a senator, a congressman, or president, or whatever, and I'm going to let my particular religion influence me, well, what about the people that I'm governing that aren't my religion? What about them? I mean, that's what they should be focusing on. If you're religious or you keep talking about faith in God and God bless America, what about the people that don't believe in God? You mean you're just going to screw them or what? What's the deal with that? You shouldn't be talking about this stuff. So I think that needs to be said. People are afraid to death to say that because America is so religious, and anybody who's running for office wouldn't dare say it because they'll never get elected. But that's a problem.
I'm speaking with Michael Shermer. The title of his latest book is Science Friction. Do you ever feel like you're missing something in not having a sort of interest in mysterious phenomena from a kind of wonder position, or I don't know exactly how to describe that, but an irrational or...
I understand what you're asking.
Okay.
I don't miss anything there. In fact, I think science has far more sort of transcendent, spiritual, mysterious worldview than anything offered by religion or the New Age or the spiritual movement or anything like that, because our worldview is just grand. It's huge. I mean, think of the size of the cosmos and deep, deep space, how far away things are, how big the cosmos is, or deep time, how far back in time things go. I mean, you know, the spacecraft furthest away from us is the Voyager spacecraft, launched in 1976. It is hurtling out of the solar system at 40,000 miles an hour. It's flying. And if it were going to the nearest star system, which is the Alpha Centauri star system, which is only 4.6 light years away, which is really close by cosmic standards, at 40,000 miles an hour, it would take 70,000 years to get there. It's just empty space. There's nothing out there. It's a huge, vacuous cosmos. How amazing it is that we're even here to appreciate that. And that's far grander a worldview than anything offered by religion or the New Age. And if anybody traffics in mysteries, it's science. Science is constantly exploring these incredible mysteries of quantum mechanics and neurons. How is it that a bundle of neurons firing can produce consciousness, that can produce a state of awareness? I mean, we can sort of imagine mechanically how a bundle of neurons could be sensitive to light and fire when it's hit by photons of light, something like that. And maybe you can even envision how another bundle of neurons is told when that other bundle of neurons picks up light from the retina, something like that. But where does self-awareness come from? The fact that I'm aware that I'm aware. And even more than that, I'm aware that you're aware. And I'm aware that you're aware that I'm aware. Now, this is really getting weird. Where in the brain does that happen? And then I have a sense of self and a sense of non-self. You're not me. This microphone's not me. But I'm me. But where is the me? And when I go to sleep, it goes away somewhere, but it comes back in the morning. And when I go under anesthesia, the self goes away. But then it comes back. Well, where'd it go? Where was it in the first place? Nobody knows. I mean, it's an incredibly great, profound mystery. And that, to me, is much greater than anything I've ever read in the New Age movement or psychic power or God and religion, any of that. It pales by comparison.
Do you ever get the criticism that you've replaced your own evangelical Christianity with a religious fervor around science?
Yes.
What do you say?
I suppose it, you know, guilty as charged in a sense. But if anything, I'm even more enthusiastic about science for all the reasons I just said. It's so grandiose and spectacular, but it's also at the same time humbling. I don't in the least bit feel I have absolute truth or that I really do now know. I only feel that we have provisional theories about things, but that I can participate in trying to understand it better and push the frontiers a little bit further.
And where does where do you think the writing or the thinking about this topic will go in the future?
Well, the whole science and religion debate is a hot one these days, mainly because of the Templeton Foundation pouring money into institutions to stage debates on science and religion. It's really a top-down, follow-the-money kind of movement, this particular case. Usually that's not what happens, but in this case it is. I think the subject catches on well, though, because people are interested in it. How could you not be interested in whether there's a God or not and what the relationship is between science and religion and if there is such a thing as spiritual entities and angels or ESP? What, I mean, you'd have to be made out of wood to not be interested in this stuff or to look at these Hubble Space Telescope pictures and not have a profound sense of awe about the cosmos. Gosh darn it, you have to be dead to not just get excited about that. And so that will always continue, I think.
And what's the Templeton Foundation's stake in the whole thing?
Oh, well, John Templeton is the billionaire who made a lot of money on the Templeton Fund. It's a mutual fund. And he's a spiritual man. He's a Christian. He's a very religious man, very thoughtful, I think, intelligent, nice. He seems like a nice person. But he feels that his calling in life with all this money is to show that science is not in conflict with religion, which is good. But he takes it one step further, and he thinks that science actually supports religious tenets, mainly his, of course, and that things like prayer and healing, for example, we can pray for people to get healed, to get well. I think this is a deeply flawed – there's scientific flaws in the research that I've written about, but it's deeply flawed theologically that God somehow – what, didn't know about these sick people here until they were prayed for? I mean, I thought he was omniscient. He knows everything. So he knows they're sick. So if he knows they're sick and he's not doing anything about it until somebody prays for that person, well, what does that make God? Sort of a cosmic errand boy. Yeah, okay, I'll do it. You ask, so I'll do it. What does that mean theologically? It's very disturbing. I'm amazed that any thoughtful theologian or Christian would accept that without realizing what it means.
Michael Shermer, I want to thank you very much for coming into KBOO and talking about these very interesting topics.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And I want to let people know again that I've been speaking with Michael Shermer. The title of his most recent book is Science Friction, subtitle, Where the Known Meets the Unknown. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO.